About his recent... Oh, sorry. About his most recent... Is this your most recent book, Unrelenting Grace? The gifts that can come to us through our theology as United Methodists. And is your wife here? Do I see her? And there is Pam, who is also an ordained elder from the Western North Carolina Conference, and we're so glad to have you with us, too. So I'm going to hand it over to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. And I'm very grateful to Carol for her ministry here, for Tom Lee and his engagement with me and all this. I don't think this is... So I'll stay with the mic for a while. But it's wonderful to be here. There are just so many connections. I'll say that I've known Kirk McNeil my entire adult life, and appreciate him, and we stay connected, and I know his heart, as he says, is very much in this place. And just grateful to West End. I mentioned in the service, and we'll mention again, Russ and Ruth Monfort were in a church that I served for many years in their retirement, and were very important to us as well, and there are many other connections. So I'm grateful to be here, and just thank you for this church, for your witness in such an important place, and thanks for just some of you for your engagement with this book. I think I'll just kind of dive right in. Let's bow for prayer. Oh God, we thank you for your grace that saves us, for the connection we have with each other, for your image that is implanted in each of us, and for the encouragement, the motivation to grow in love with you and with each other in this life, and in the process to shape this world, to be a world that is on earth as it is in heaven. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, it's wonderful to be here, and my wife Pam is here. Pam has a background in missions and disaster relief, and especially in Haiti. She was in the earthquake in Haiti with the missionaries who died in Haiti, United Methodist missionaries. So she has that background. At one time in my life, I was vice president of one of the general boards here, and they were kind of going through work they needed to do. I was in Charlotte, and it seemed like I was in Nashville all the time. So I was here many times, and Michael Williams actually was the pastor here, and he caught up with me, and so I taught here one time about a book I'd written on intercession. So just grateful to be here. Well, let me just say a few things about the book and maybe see if you have any questions or anything you would like to say about it. But the genesis of the book was that I had served as the Bishop of Florida for a little over 10 years, and we had an election of new bishops last fall in the Southeast, and therefore potentially some new assignments. At the time, I was serving Western North Carolina and Florida, which doesn't make any sense. They're not contiguous. About 1,700 churches in the two conferences. And I just flew back and forth between Charlotte and Tampa. And I had been in Florida a long time, so we had a strong team there, and I was returning to Western North Carolina. And in the way the church works, there's a group of people who assign bishops to areas, and so you really don't know what that's going to be. They work together, laity and clergy, and they assigned me to Western North Carolina, about which we were thrilled. We loved the people of Florida, but we were thrilled to be back. So that happened in the mid-fall. It meant the very end of the year I would be leaving Florida. So typically when you leave a job, some of you have done this, you have a kind of a ritual way of departure, and that was going to happen in December in Florida. Well, Florida is a long state. It's like 12 hours, 14 hours drive from north to south, and it was really not possible to get everyone together. And so we had a gathering in Tampa, and it was live streamed. So the people in the publishing house watched it, And based on what I said, they said, we'd like you to write a book about this. Can you do it in a month? Of course, I have a full-time job. So I said, yes, I can. So that was Neil Alexander. So in what I shared with them, I was just trying to make sense of where we were. Now, a lot of what I'm going to say has been a journey you've lived as well. So in those 10 years as a conference, we had lived through the murder of Trayvon Martin. I talked to the governor at that time about that one time, whose name was Rick Scott, about the murder of Trayvon Martin. We had a biracial church in Sanford where Trayvon Martin lived. And we worked with that church and with the pastor. We had the murders in the Pulse that happened. We had United Methodist inside the Pulse. It's a mile from First United Methodist Church in Orlando, Florida, a very vital church. We had the murders at Parkland on Ash Wednesday. One of our churches also very close. And so we had those experiences. We had two massive hurricanes. We had Florida's kind of an epicenter for the political life of the nation. And Florida is an exporter of politicians to the rest of the nation. But it all happens there. And everything was very tense. And we had, the denominational conversations around unity and LGBTQ inclusion. We had kind of lived through all of that those 10 years together. Just my cards on the table, and I say everything the same way wherever I am. I had kind of made a journey in my own life from I was called to be passionate about the unity of our church to, in a nuanced way, saying that unity could not be in at the expense of one group of persons. That could not be at the expense of, especially the LGBTQ community. And I mean, I've spoken before the Judicial Council twice about that. This is not a secret. So over time, I both tried to be the bishop of everyone, and I tried to lead us in a direction. And all of this was contextual. And so then, all of a sudden, I'm leaving that area. I'm finishing a body of work and moving on. And so what do you say to people about that? And so I tried to talk about kind of three values that I think are important to us and what they can mean for us. And so the three values in the book, it's a very simple book. It's like less than $10. It was designed to be very, very non-threatening, not intimidating to anyone. We like finishing things we start, right? So it's a book you can finish, you can read, you can finish it. Three values are grace, connection, and holiness. And that grace, connection, and holiness are our pathways to healing. And that we are in need of healing. We are very broken, most of us, and we're in need of healing. Now, the healing part, personally related to that, is my experience 7 years ago of falling on a temporary stage in Portland, Oregon at General Conference during a break and rupturing a quad tendon. So they had to fly me back from Portland to Florida. I had to kind of learn how to walk again. Our daughter was going to get married a few months. I wanted to dance at her wedding, walk her down the aisle. I was pretty motivated. I was a compliant patient. And so I thought a lot about healing, people who are in the healing professions. And Then last summer, I was walking in a grocery store and I just stepped in a puddle of water and hit my shoulder and broke it. And so I had another rehab for like a few weeks and lasted a few months. So I thought a lot about this in terms of healing. And that's where the book moves toward the end, how our families can be healed, how our churches can be healed, how our communities, neighborhoods, nation, world. So that's really where, that's really what the book is about. The chapter on grace is just very basic, and that is that we are saved by grace through faith, Ephesians 2:8-9, and this is the gift of God. That this is all a gift, this faith that we have. Let me test and see. Okay, so this is going to be good. So grace is really, for me, foundational to inclusion for the Christian church and for people who want to be in a relationship with Jesus or God or wonder if they could. It's the question of inclusion. That is the first question anyone asks. So we have two daughters. They're in their mid-30s now. When they were looking at colleges, and Carol's are in children's school now, we'd take them to visit schools, you know, and they were very different than the visits I took. Ours were like visiting summer camps. You know, theirs were like visiting, you know, spas and things like that. But they would talk about the school. These are the athletics. These are the academics. These are the alumni networks. This is the endowment. And as I was walking with them in these schools, my mind would be at the questions of inclusion. Can my child be accepted here? Can we afford to go here? You know, the question of inclusion. And, you know, we can be very eloquent about the Christian faith and reflect on it at length. Many people are right there at the place of inclusion. Am I accepted in this group? And that's grace. And grace is fundamental. And I do mention there's a page in the book where I talk about how we have done staggering harm to two groups of people. Our church has. I'm a part of that. I'm complicit in that. And one group are persons of color, especially African Americans. To me, it is a miracle that African Americans embrace the Christian faith, based on the experience of the last several hundred years. It is truly, to me, one of the supernatural evidences of the truth of Christianity. That here's a group of people who were enslaved by Christian people. And we had great awakenings all over the world that didn't even touch on this. And most of the language of the Great Awakenings are the language of our hymns. And it's a miracle. And second are LGBTQ persons. And I can tell you, especially as I was doing the work of the Commission on the Way Forward, and I was a pastor for 28 years, I really come at this more as a pastor. People would call me and say, you know, Dr. Carter, can I talk to you on my way home from work? Pastor, can I see you in the morning for breakfast? Can I come by right now? And then they would want to talk with me about someone in their family. And a main character for me became the woman who was born in this church, baptized in this church, confirmed in this church, in the youth group of this church, in the campus ministry of this church, in a Sunday school class in this church, gives money to this church, gives money to capital campaigns in this church, sings in the choir of this church. And at the end of her life, is she going to wonder, was this ever really my church? That person became a main character for me. And so we've done staggering harm to these persons. And that's a part of the brokenness, part of our brokenness. The only thing that saves us from that is grace. The grace of Jesus Christ and the cross. And so part of what that means is to know that if I'm saved, it's only through the grace of Jesus Christ. I'm a lifelong Southerner. I have to say that, right? And then second, to try to show grace to other people. You know, it's just been a hard few years, amen? And we had people, Pam and I both had people die in our families of COVID who should still be alive. And we've not always been at our best. Other people have not always been at their best. And so how to live by grace and to accept grace and to kind of start all over. Share an amazing experience shared with me by a clergywoman and then her sister. So this woman is a judge in Atlanta, and she is a United Methodist, happens to be a United Methodist, happens to be the sister of a clergywoman. And she's hearing a case about human trafficking. And the woman on the stand is an African woman in the middle of the city of Atlanta. And she tells the story of being in a grocery store, realizing she's some distance away from the person who has held her captive, that this might be her chance to get away. And so she runs out of the grocery store, and she looks to her left, and there's a building with a cross and a flame on it. And she runs toward it, goes inside, and they call the police. Turns out she was a United Methodist from Africa. And the judge is a United Methodist. Her name is Beth Coppedge. She was the ambassador for human trafficking during the Obama administration. And she and I are reading somebody's dissertation on human trafficking right now at Duke, a thesis. But that's grace. That's the cross and the flame. That's what it means, that we're saved by grace. And so how can we sort of get back to that? There's a chapter on connection, and I've talked about remembering the body, how we literally remember the body, put it back together again, how we reconnect. And, you know, we are a connection of people. Just being here is wonderful to be with you and to get to talk with several of you, have this morning to get to see Carol's ministry and the other clergy and the staff, and to know that this has been a very important place for people in their journeys. We have one of our largest churches, West Market Street in Greensboro, the center of the city of the church, a block from where the civil rights movement began in Greensboro. Woman is the staff parish chair named Pam Barrett. And Pam Barrett went to graduate school here. I think her husband went to law school here. She told me that was our church. She's told me that before. So she was the staff parish chair. They received an African-American pastor. She chaired the committee, and they said, we are actually open to a person of color or to a woman as our senior leader. And her faith, she couldn't tell her faith journey, right, without this church. That's the connection. We are all connected to each other. We are a connection. We are better together. It's not just a bureaucracy or a franchise. It's just our way of being church. And as I talk about, it's not the only way to be church. And I'm convinced a lot of the disaffiliation, it is about exclusion, but a lot of it's also about the desire for independence. Our way of being church is connectional. You know, when I was a pastor for 28 years, the last church I served, the one in the city of Charlotte, was a very affluent area of Charlotte. And the bishop at the time said to me, you know, you might be elected a bishop. I think you ought to be open to being a district superintendent. And he was right. That was right for me. So my salary went down like by a third or something. Pam was a wonderful person to be alongside that. And I went to the 7 western counties of North Carolina, all in the area of Appalachia. The lowest per capita income of the conference. But you know what? It had the highest apportionment giving. The people with the least materially gave the most. And a couple of years ago, they were flooded. And I told that story. They had a flood that affected 1,000 people, and a number of people were never found. And so I told that story all over the conference. This is our time to be in connection with them in mutuality. Several of the years I was on a task force here in Nashville, one of the persons I came to know and love was a man named Tom Choi, Reverend Tom Choi, who is the superintendent of Hawaii. A very gifted person. And so I wrote him and their bishop, Dottie Escobedo, and said, our conference is going to send you some money just for you to figure out how you need to use it. I'm a big fan of UMCOR, period. And, no, this is not either or, and there's some things UMCOR doesn't do, like help with things local church staffs need. For example, that's not an UMCOR thing. They're not taking up offerings, those kind of things. And so just the relationship with Tom, that's been a decades-long thing. And people have those relationships all through us. And that's the connection. And so how do we work on the connection in a time when things are frayed? And I'll just share with you an experience I had. I'm not the hero of a story. I don't know really what good it did, but it's an example of the kind of things ordinary people do. So during the pandemic, my mother passed a little bit before the pandemic. She had a sister, my favorite aunt, who was still alive. And during the pandemic, I went with my sister to see her, and I was able to thank her for her role in our lives, her relationship with my mother, some things her family did for our family that I could look back and see they had done. She had 4 children, my cousins, and they were always my closest cousins until 2016. And then the relationship just went quiet. And I think it went quiet because of some things. I don't get on a political grandstand, but it went quiet because of some responses I made to things the president said about women or Haitians. I don't go out of my way looking for these things. They were just things that my silence would have been to me unfaithful. And things just went quiet with my cousins in Georgia. And so I thought when my aunt and died, I thought, I need to call them. I just need to take an afternoon and call all four of them and say, I'm grateful for your mother. I loved her. She was wonderful to our family. You're important to me, and I'm praying for you, and I want us to have a relationship. So I did that with my cousins, Ray, David, Kathy, and Carol. And I don't know what it has led to, but I felt like it was kind of a window that I might not have again to try to peer into. And I have a sense that we've lived through all these things, you know, racial murders, whether to wear a mask or not, COVID, the mental health strain, not being able to celebrate important rituals together. And there's just division within almost every group. And our church is no different. And so one of the audiences for this book was how to live in connection after all of this. Does that make sense? And it's just important, I think, that we try to rebuild the connection, that we search for common ground. That sounds like a cliche, but that we search for ways to be in relationship with each other. And so that's what the chapter on connection is about. And then the third chapter is on holiness, and I talk about this in the sermon. But, you know, we are a holiness church movement, but a part of the reason for the mess we are in is a flawed teaching about holiness. Holiness is not, I'm superior to you, or you to me. Holiness is not, we exclude one group of people, we become more holy. That's certainly not the way Jesus lived, right? I mean, that was not Jesus' understanding of holiness, with lepers, with lots of categories of people. He just crossed those lines. Holiness, and I talk about this in the sermon, is love of God and love of neighbor. That's Wesleyan. And that's teaching after teaching and sermon after sermon of John Wesley, and it's the hymns of Charles Wesley. Holiness is becoming more loving people, loving God, loving our neighbor. That's how we become holy. That's to be made perfect in love in this life. It's not separation. It's not exclusion. It's love. And to spread scriptural holiness is not to create more people who want to exclude other people. That's not spreading scriptural holiness. Spreading scriptural holiness is trying to have more influence and to create more loving people. And so the point of the book is grace, connection, and holiness are our pathways to healing. And I think I'll stop here and then see if you've got a question or two. I know our time is about up. When I had the fractured humerus last summer, you know, all of a sudden I had to see an orthopedist about that. I'm blessed to have health care. I had a lower back thing, an L4 vertebrae thing, so a physical therapist and MRI and x-rays and all that's going on. And so my prayer became, Lord, today let me meet a healing person. That was my prayer. Let me encounter a healing person. This is in the book. And that was my prayer. And you know, I did meet healing persons. One was an MRI technician. One was an office manager. One was a physician's assistant. One was a nurse. One was a physical therapist. I love physical therapists. And the physical therapist, one day we'd gotten to know each other a little bit, and he said, he's just a young guy, and he said, you know, I've been thinking about going into the ministry. And I said, look at me. You are in the ministry. You're in the ministry of healing. You're healing people. That's what Jesus did. You know, Jesus did three things. He was a preacher, he was a teacher, and he was a healer. And people cared about his preaching and teaching primarily because of his healing. He healed a man who was born blind. He begins to teach about, I'm the light of the world. You're the light of the world. So how can we become healing people? Now, healing is not just a warm, fuzzy idea. It's really not niceness. Because for me to get to a place of being healed, you have to get in alignment, right? Healing does include justice, and it does include mercy and love. But how can we be a healing people? So getting back to a last sentence about how this relates to discipleship. I truly believe that I used to wonder, when can we work through all this and get to the work of being disciples? What I came to believe was, in the season we're living in, this is what it means to be a disciple. To be a reconciler, to be a healer, to be a voice for justice, to cross boundaries, to have uncomfortable situations, to reach out to people who we don't agree with. That's discipleship. This is the season God's given us to live in. It's not an interruption that we hope to get through and then get to normality. There is no normal. This is the time God gives us to live. It can be a great time to be the church and to be the United Methodist Church. And God's given us these three gifts: grace, connection, and holiness. So thank you, and just thanks for who you are. And I know our time, we don't have much time, but just a question or two. Yes.
That much of the disaffiliation is in the South, and that white males are a part of that problem or challenge, if you will, and that I wonder what your observation would be about that. And in some ways, people even link this back to still remnants of the Civil War that are still being fought, and that maybe the church has become the grounds for that fight. What is your thought?
Tell me your name, sir.
Ray.
Gray? Ray. Thank you, Ray. Just a quick response. In our metrics, most of the clergy are white male. That's true. Almost no clergy women in churches that have disaffiliated. Almost no persons of color. Mostly white male. Mostly non-seminary educated, which means they're local pastors who are mostly in rural churches. Now, that doesn't mean rural churches are disappearing from the United Methodist Church. It just means of the churches that are disaffiliating, most of them are rural, and yet there are still a lot of rural churches that are still there. It's interesting, there was a court case, Union Springs versus, I forget the other party, in Alabama. It was the Trust Clause case. I remember one of my seminary professors talking about it one day in class, and a group went out into the yard of the church and stuck a sign that said Union Springs Southern Methodist Church. And that went through the courts, and they found for the denomination they were opposed to the civil rights language and desegregation of schools and the denomination's voice in that. I do think that is in the DNA of all of this, of the disaffiliation. There's And again, I've, you know, I was, as introduction, I was part of the Commission on the Way Forward. I worked on the protocol with Kenneth Feinberg. I've spent a lot of time with the leaders of the church that's departed. I don't demonize them. We just disagree about vision of the church. I think a part of it is the desire to be independent. That's a big part of it. And the part they bury is that they really have to discriminate against LGBTQ persons to be doing this. They wanna make that a lowercase thing. What we've learned in some churches, especially in Florida, was if a church was going to disaffiliate, often I would say this about men, I'm a male, most churches I go to, most of the worshipers are women. Most meetings I have about disaffiliation, most of the people there are men. It's just very, that's just a fact. And so we've had churches where the church wanted to disaffiliate and did disaffiliate. And this is a minority of our churches. It's a supermajority are remaining. But then people in the church would realize, because the story was told truthfully, that it was because of their stance on homosexuality and LGBTQ, people would come to the church and say, I can't be in this church anymore. Sometimes because of, they'd be in Tallahassee because of my work with the university or my work with the government or Atlanta, my work with Delta Airlines, or just my family. Does that make sense? So all that's kind of a part of it. Yes. And the book is really about, it's written for people in the style of people maybe who've lost some friends from their church, who've gone to another church, or maybe they had to leave their church building. A lot of it is kind of getting reoriented toward that.
Do you have suggestions for me and whoever else is dealing with this? I have a sort of arrogance of, I'm progressive, I see this way of connection, and yet I'm not really living with differences very well. So I'm wondering if there's some Wesleyan pathways for dealing with my own hubris.
I think we're all there if we're honest. Yeah. You know, I think Wesley, the Catholic spirit that Wesley wrote about, if we cannot think not alike, can we love alike? We are going to have differences. What seems to be different is how violent things have become. And how to be nonviolent. And so that's kind of a part of it. I mean, our time is running out, but I could share with you a couple of experiences where people who I would just assume to be living in a very different world did something that was extraordinarily grace-filled. And so how we can just find some point of connection and affirm something that like that. There's someone who said, what we feed grows. And how we can find a point of connection and build a relationship. And at the same time say, this is who I am. This is what I believe. And, I've tried to in this role, center the voices of people I think have been harmed. Like when we make appointments, when we do things, and yet I've tried to stay in relationship with people who might not agree with all of that. And it's not a perfect art. But I think how do we do what you just said with joy? And how do we want to stay in relationship with people? And maybe what Wesley would go on to say is, let us join hands and do the work of God. You know, how can we find ways to be in mission together? the fact is we are becoming more and more siloed, kind of in every way, all the media we watch and the things we read. And I've done a lot of work in Northern Ireland. That's another story for another day, but that's been very instructive in how they really have two completely different narratives of everything. And we're on that pathway to that. So, yeah.
Oh, I wish we could stay and continue the conversation, but some of us haven't been to worship yet, and you have a wonderful word to hear in worship. So let's just take a moment to thank and praise God for the gifts that Bishop Carter has brought to our midst. Thank you.